for the win! Yes! Yes!
At the buzzer, McCord on its way!
They have to get it. No timeouts, they do.
Courtside with Cats and Coach G, the definitive college basketball podcast.
It is Mason straight away against Fox. Crossover dribble off the Lucas screen. Double team comes. Kicks to Graham at the logo to the top. Steps in. Jumper off the right side of the rim. Tapped up by Jackson. Offensive rebound. Lays it up and in. Off the glass, Josh Jackson. He puts Kansas up 73-66. 60 seconds to go.
And we courtesy their ESPN Radio with the delivery of Kansas's 79-73 victory over Kentucky Saturday night at Rupp Arena. I'm Andy Katz along with my co-host Seth Greenberg. You're listening to Courtside with Katz and Coach G, the headline game of the SEC and Big 12 Challenge. You also heard in our regular tease from last year's championship game that winning shot by Chris Jenkins of Villanova. Well, once again, Villanova with a last-second victory, this time on Sunday over Virginia. We'll discuss that as well as the week ahead, as Gonzaga's Mark Few will join us, as well as Georgia Tech's Josh Pastner. The Yellow Jackets, believe it or not, looking like an NCAA tournament team at this juncture. So, Seth, let's first go backwards, as we like to do here. You were at Rupp Arena on Saturday night. We just heard the delivery of that play-by-play of Josh Jackson's putback. You know, in the pregame, all everyone was talking about was potentially the advantage inside with Bam Adebayo and Carlton Bragg not being eligible because he was suspended for the game by Kansas, and yet it was the rebounding, especially on the offensive putbacks like Josh Jackson, that really ended up being the difference. What did you see?
Well, Josh Jackson, to me, was the toughest matchup for Kentucky coming into the game. They didn't have a matchup for Josh Jackson. If you think about it, you need Derek Willis on the floor to make threes and to open up the floor. That's a bad matchup. Wenyen Gabriel is going to be a good player, but Jackson's versatility, his quickness, his toughness, his relentless approach to the game, that was a bad matchup, and Kansas took advantage of that. But the game was won, to me, by maturity and toughness, and that was Frank Mason. Terrific basketball game, great decisions by both coaches throughout the games, changing defenses, making adjustments out of timeouts. We can get into that later, but to me, it was the maturity of Kansas, their toughness, Frank Mason's ability to take the challenge. He's heard all about Monk. He's heard all about Fox. But Graham and Mason, their experience, their maturity, their toughness, to me, along with a couple of very terrific adjustments by Bill Self, were the difference in the game.
So let's break that down a little. Let's hear from Bill Self about one of those adjustments that he made during the game that might have been a little surprising in terms of defensively what he tried.
Well, we didn't guard him very well early, but you know, we went zone, and I think the zone maybe got him to stand a little bit because I didn't feel like we could really stop him basically to start the second half. But we stuck with it, and fortunately for us, ball kind of bounced our way, and then we played great offensively second. As poor as we were the first half offensively, we were that good the second half.
So Bill Self is referring to Malik Monk of Kentucky, and he's talking about the zone. What do you think of that decision there, Seth?
He started actually at the end of the first half. They went to the zone when Briscoe went out, and basically what they did was it enabled them to own the tempo of the game. It slowed Kentucky down. Kentucky had to reset, pull it out, probe the defense. It changed the tempo of the game. Kentucky made some turnovers. First half, think about this. Kentucky gave up 17 points in their half-court defense. They gave up 10 points off of turnovers. Those turnovers were created out of that zone. So, you know, the decision to go zone, and he played a little triangle too as well, basically tilted the game in favor of Kansas because it took Kentucky out of some type of rhythm, some type of flow, and within the zone, they did a good job of locating Malik Monk and making him hard for him to catch the ball with room and rhythm. So, terrific decision, changing defenses, which changed the tempo, the flow of the game. And that was really big because early in the game, Kentucky's out in transition. They're punching the ball inside to Bam Adebayo. He's catching it. He's either scoring it or pitching it back out for step-in threes. And the zone definitely impacted the game.
You know, we've talked a lot on this show over the last couple of years that teams that have these great freshmen, sometimes they're not going to be as successful, reach their potential, unless they have the, you know, experienced upperclassmen. We saw that two seasons ago with Duke, and you cannot underestimate the importance of someone like Quinn Cook and then winning the national championship. In this case with Kentucky, let's hear what John Calipari said about the inexperience in a way that might have cost them.
The whole thing for us turnover-wise is when we make easy plays, we don't turn it over. When we're trying to make a harder play, like if a guy's open in the corner, just throw it to him. Why would you ball fake him and then run a guy over? Why would you, versus an extra pass to the wing, you're going to try to force one inside, which gets tipped away. You're driving, and they're in. There is no drive. It's a swing and then a drive. I mean, it's all freshman kind of stuff.
So with that being said, Seth, you know, we've talked a lot about this, you know, where, you know, John has these unbelievable freshmen, but there are times when that inexperience can rear its head. It's almost February in a couple of days. How concerned should Kentucky be about that inexperience factor with so many freshmen playing major minutes?
Every game they're going to get better. Every game they're going to understand what they did wrong, what they need to adjust. I mean, games like they played this past weekend are really good because, you know, what it does is it gives John a point of reference with his team, a teaching point, a teachable moment, as some people would say. So can they get better? Sure they can get better. I mean, look, Monk and Fox are explosive in transition. All right, but they're young and they play young. And that's what I tweeted out during the game. They were playing young. And young is not just on the offensive end. Young's on the defensive end. Can you maintain a defensive intensity for the length of possession? Can you stay tough on the basketball? Can you get into help? Will you not take a playoff? Will you put your body in position to help and then recover on balance? All those things are reflections of a young basketball team. Then offensively, I don't think Kentucky has selfishness. I just think if you look at their team, at the end of a game, Malik Monk's instinct, because of his basketball career, is it's a close game, I'm going to go win it, I'm going to go make a play. Because you know what? That's what he's done, whether it was in high school or AAU basketball. Now, he's got four other guys can make a play. It doesn't have to be on his shoulders. So learning to trust each other, being in that situation, probably doing more time and score in practice. Can they get better? Sure, they'll get better. Could they take a step backwards and revert? No doubt about it. But this experience helps them to move forward. They played against two grown men in the backcourt. Frank Mason is a grown man. And for all those draft nicks and draft gurus, let me tell you something. I don't know where you have him. That guy's going to play in the NBA. He's going to be on a winning team. And he's going to help your team be better because he's a winning player. He makes good decisions. He can make shots. He has a toughness about him. Graham and Mason were tougher, not maybe better, but tougher and better in this game than Monk and Fox. They played tougher. And tougher means that they made sure they got the shot they wanted. Tougher means they made the right decision when they went in the lane. If the defense shrunk, they made the pass. If the defense didn't, they finished at the rim. That's what you do when you've been in school for 3 and 4 years. So, to me, a little bit surprising. The zone took Bam out of the game, and when he got touches, and the big thing is they got the ball to Bam in the second half against the zone, Andy. But what happened is because they were in zone, they were able to scrape down and dig the ball out and put pressure on him so he didn't have angles. And then all of a sudden when he kicked it out, they could still close out to the shooters. And the one unsung hero for Kansas, Landon Lucas. I thought he was really good in the second half.
Yeah.
Thought in the second half, he made himself available. They played through him a little bit more. He finished. He got to the offensive glass. He played off penetration. I thought he was really – he played at a very high level in the second half. And Josh Jackson was just a bad matchup for Kentucky. Jackson plays – with a lot of energy, he's terrific on the baseline. He's active getting to the glass. When he rebounds the ball, he can initiate your break. Jackson is a really tough matchup because of his versatility, and he was a matchup nightmare for Kentucky.
So you mentioned winning. So far in the last year and a half, there hasn't been a program that has won more than this one. Let's hear how they did it on Sunday.
Wildcat basketball. Here we go. 10 seconds to go. Brunson against Parentes as he crosses the timeline. Nice bounce choice. Pass to Hart. 3 seconds. Two. Hart, runner in the lane. Puts up the shot. No good. Tipped at the rebound. DiVincenzo. It's good.
That's going to be awfully close, Bill. That's
we'll see if it counts.
Very close.
DiVincenzo mobbed by his teammates. The shot was missed. The horn went as the tip. DiVincenzo could be the hero of this game if this counts. They're going to check it. What a comeback if this holds up by Villanova.
Dante DiVincenzo with the bucket there for Villanova. We courtesy ESPN Radio. And once again, Villanova, right place, right town, Virginia. Outstanding defensively right before that bucket. They hold them to 59 points. That's the 61st point, obviously, for Villanova for the victory. Your views right now on Villanova and their ability to once again be in the position to make a winning play.
That's kind of who they are, Andy. You understand they have a small margin of error, and that doesn't mean they're not a terrific team. They are a terrific team. But because they play at a slow pace, because they don't crush you on the offensive glass, because they only run on opportunity, fewer possessions, they have a small margin of error. So they're used to playing in these type of games. Are they a terrific defensive team? Yeah. Do they have a physicality? Yeah, but they're not. It's not like they're throwing the ball into the block and playing out of that. They've got to make plays. They've got to move you. They've got to move the ball. And then they've got to basically attack matchups, which Jay does such a terrific job with. And Mikal Bridges, to me, is their X factor. You know, look, DiVincenzo made the tap in, and they need to get something out of the bench. They play seven guys. Seven guys. I mean, DiVincenzo and Pascal played 19 minutes a game. They have a seven-man rotation. They rely on their starters. Once Reynolds comes out, basically, they split the rest of those minutes amongst those two guys. But when Mikal Bridges plays well, offensively, defensively, they're a different team because he's the one guy at 6'7", kind of electric, that can do a lot of different things. He can knock down a three. He can get to the basket. He can get you an offensive rebound. But Villanova's a team that's comfortable being in an uncomfortable situation. And what I mean by that is they're comfortable at the end of the game. They're comfortable in close games. They're comfortable playing from behind, maybe not as behind as they were yesterday, because they have confidence in their defense. They know they can get stops. And they have a number of different guys that can make plays, whether it's Brunson, whether it's Hart, whether it's Bridges, whether it's Jenkins making a big shot. So terrific basketball game. And for all the people that say, you know, freedom of movement, there's got to be scoring. You know, scoring is entertaining. You can't tell me that game yesterday wasn't entertaining. You can't tell me that wasn't basketball at the very highest
who's
level.
Who's saying so, it's not entertaining?
Well, I mean, we always talk people? About who, you know, everyone wants more scoring. Well, you know what? A good defensive battle of two teams that can pass and catch and cut and move the defense. You know, Virginia, they call it embracing the pace. I just say, look, the goal offensively is to get a good shot. If it takes you 5 seconds, 10 seconds, or 27 seconds to get a good shot. And then defensively, good defensive teams are hard to score against. So when you're hard to score against, you're going to have longer possessions. But that's really good basketball. And to me, Virginia, Villanova, that to me was it was enjoyable to watch. Two teams playing the game the right way, with great intensity, with great passion, with great sense of purpose. Nothing better than watching two teams who know who they are, how they win, and stick to their identity. And that's what happened yesterday.
Speaking of Sunday, Northwestern, by the way, beat Indiana 68-55. The Wildcats, which I should note, have not lost since Chris Collins appeared on courtside. Just a little fact.
Oh, exactly. Here. It's the bump. It's
it
the
is
bump,
the bump.
I know, Andy.
Okay, so since he appeared on courtside, which was after their win at Nebraska, they've won five in a row heading into their showdown at Purdue on Wednesday night. They're 7-2 in the Big Ten. That's their best start in the Big Ten in 79 years. Okay. They have not finished in the top three since, if I'm not mistaken, 1959-60. So right now they are they're alone in second place because there's a tie for first between Maryland and Wisconsin. I'm now on the bandwagon. I think they're going to get in, barring a complete collapse, which I do not anticipate. What are your thoughts on not just the bump from courtside, but Whether or not this Northwestern team...
Do you take the credit for losses also, Andy?
Well, we have to because, you know, there's been some that have gone the other direction.
But you just... You typically don't talk about them.
Yeah, we just won't discuss it.
Typical media.
No, we're going to block it out.
Yeah, well, yeah, when you see something that you write something that happens, you know, well, as I told you last week...
No, I don't do that. I never say that.
But then when something happens that you said, you... Act like you have amnesia. Not you, just in general. I've been on this bandwagon for a month, so, I mean, I just like their team.
Were you driving it, or you just joined it?
No, I mean, I like their team. I think that they have they have Big Ten depth right now. They have Big Ten athleticism. They've got a terrific backcourt in Lindsey McIntosh. I think Law changes their team a little bit because he's got a little bounce to him. Getting Pardon back is was huge. Skelly comes off the bench, can make some shots. I like their basketball team. I like how they play. They run on opportunity. They play with great spacing. They've got a toughness about them. I just think they're a good basketball team, and Chris has done a great job, and they're fun to watch. And, you know, look, if the Cubs can win it all, who knows?
I'd like
Dan
to know.
Dockett, he'll be wearing a Northwestern tie before long.
I'd like to know if anyone in Chicago took that bet in the same year that you'd get the Cubs winning the World Series and Northwestern in the NCAA tournament. I wonder what that would pay out.
I'm not sure that was on the line. I'm not a gambler, but I mean, if someone had that, you know, if some book had that, that's a creative dude right there now. Creative.
Back to Reyes on the left baseline. Into the paint. Sweeping hook. Rejected by Zach Collins.
Great response by the freshman Collins.
Perkins the other way. Leaves it for Karnowski running by his side. Shem lays it in. The Bulldogs are up by 34.
Wow. Gonzaga continues to pour it on.
And that was Gonzaga's 96-46 victory over Pepperdine. Credit to the Gonzaga IMG Sports Network, as you heard Karnowski with the transition lay-in there, and now we're joined on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line by Gonzaga head coach Mark Few. And, Coach, you know, we've talked so much, and we're going to address this later in our podcast about scheduling, because I know we're going to be discussing this. You know, in years past, you guys have had that non-conference game in the middle of the WCC. Why did you go away from that this season?
I don't know that we necessarily went away from it. Our league schedule changed, so we were left with no choice. We, for whatever reason, voted again to start our league season, push it back after Christmas, because I don't think people wanted to play league games prior to that. So then that kind of compacted everything down into, we're playing 18 straight league games. You know, we don't have any buys, you know, when you play your travel partner or anything like that. So we didn't have an opportunity to, you know, shove a game in there like we usually do and like we usually like to.
You know, so often, Mark, when there are transfers, it's kind of hit or miss, especially maybe if they're fifth-year guys. We've seen it work out sometimes, and sometimes it does not. You've got three players who are making major contributions to this basketball team. Why is it working so well for Gonzaga?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to other places. For us, the transfer thing has worked really well. I think our culture is really, really strong, and it's got some real depth to it. And, you know, I think we do a nice job of finding the guys that want to be a part of this and understand what Gonzaga is all about. And it's about team and they come here for the right reasons. They want to win. You know, they're looking to win and get in the NCAA tournament and advance in the NCAA tournament. And they're also looking for a development piece that I think we do a really nice job with. So I think probably why it works so well here is everybody's on the same page, and that's what's presented to them up front. And then I'd like to think we even over-deliver on the things that we talk about in the recruiting process. And then the other thing that you got to add is that they've been great, great people of high character, and they've made sacrifices maybe in their own numbers and shots and even minutes in some cases for the good of the team, which is a pretty remarkable statement, you know, in that, like, in some instances, you know, Jordan Matthews didn't get here until September, and was just kind of being assimilated into the group. And he's, done a wonderful job of that.
Fury, like the next few weeks, you guys are going to have to deal with listening to all the gurus say, are they number one?
I thought you were a guru.
Should they be number one? I'm not a guru. All right. Are they number one? Should they be number one? Are they number one seed? Did they deserve it? You know, who have they beaten? All that stuff. How do you deal with that with your team?
Well, let's see. That's first of all, I don't know how much we all sit around and listen to it. Secondly, because we're just so busy and caught up in what we're doing day to day, as you know. I mean, your days are pretty much filled, you know, now with practice, film, preparation, you know, workouts,
school.
I have obviously school and tutoring and things like that. So, and then secondly, guru. Guru back in the day meant, you know, person of, you know, high wisdom, I guess, you know, extreme knowledge and intelligence. Now, I would put you in that category, Seth. So, to me, you are a guru. I don't know about whoever else.
I don't talk about it.
Whoever else is waxing on about this, I don't know if I'd throw it out there. The thing that this team coach has done a great job of is we set out to like get better each week, you know, and like, okay, guys, we got to be better, you know, on Thursday than we were, you know, this past weekend. And they've been very, very diligent about kind of adhering to that. And, you know, we've been using Monday and Tuesdays to just really to get after it, to scrimmage, to kind of have our own, you know, competition type days. Those have been really highly competitive, and then we start preparing for our opponents on Wednesday. I don't foresee that being any different. I think it's healthy. It's nice that we're in the debate and that people are talking about us. They're talking about our program. They're talking about our school. I think everybody brings up. I'm sure they'll bring up some very legitimate points. You know, this year, there's a lot there's a group of teams that I think you could, you know, any one of them could be considered number one. The polls, you know, are just kind of a reflection of who's winning at the time and who happened to take a loss last week. You know, the only one that, you know, that truly matters is that one at the end of the year. So, I think with this club, if we can just keep getting better, then, I mean, we're certainly deserving to be in that mix.
You talk about your approach during the course of the week. You know, you play Thursday, Saturday, and you know, working on your team Monday and Tuesday, obviously, to try to be the best version of yourself. But you've got a game this Thursday at the Marriott Center against kind of an interesting team because they've got a physical front court player like you would have in Mika, and then you've got some perimeter guys that can really score it. So as you look ahead to BYU, what's the toughest thing about going to Provo and playing that team? Like, say, the two things as you prepare for this game, what are the two things you're going to tell your team, hey, these are two things that are really important as we prepare for this game this week?
I mean, great question. And
that's because he's a guru.
Yeah, that's why he is the guru. You know, he can bring it like that. So BYU presents a totally unique challenge in that, and I don't think most people out there are aware of this at all. I mean, we're going to walk into a building that's got, I mean, they've reconfigured it, but I don't know if it's 19 or 20,000 people. I don't know how many teams in college basketball, you know, and with a passion that is just, you know, pretty unbelievable. The BYU teams play with incredible pace. Their transition game is just nonstop. They're going to come at you. There aren't many teams in the country that have the freedom and the confidence that they play with to, you know, to shoot the ball out to 25, 28 feet at any time on the clock. And, you know, at times you might say, well, that's not a great shot, but you know, if they start raining in, which sometimes they do, you got your hands full. And then they have an inside player that, you know, is up there with any inside player in the country. I mean, he reminds me of Domantas Sabonis and Mika, and just how hard he is, how big, how physical, how strong he is, how many times they put the ball in his hands. And then the other thing that Dave's teams do, I mean, they play incredibly hard. They play incredibly physical. They throw a lot of bodies out at you. And it's just going to be a really, really intense environment with a really physical approach with, you know, an offense that can just come at you in a bunch of different ways. And then, ironically, Coach, I mean, this, you know, we've played the last 2 weeks, you know, St. Mary's and actually Santa Clara under Herb Sendek. They're playing at about like 330, 340 pace of play, you know, Virginia type pace of play. And now to flip, you got to switch gears, and we're going to spend a ton of time on our transition defense on getting back, because this team is going to play as fast as anybody in the country. So, you know, it's just, that's the beauty of league play. You play different styles and different ways of doing things.
So, Mark, with that being said, what are the chances that Killian Tilly, who's been out the last couple of games, could come back for you?
You know, he is starting to progress. It was a pretty serious ankle sprain. And, I mean, we're gonna try to, you know, be as patient as we can with it. He ran and jumped and did some defensive slides over the weekend, and it's starting to come around. He's a real, you know, important cog to us, because he gives us, you know, four legitimate, you know, front court players. He gives us that athleticism. He gives us energy, and he's just got an exceptional feel for the game. So in a game that is going up and down and is kind of crazy, or switching defenses or whatever, Killian's got such a great feel. He's just kind of a problem solver out there. So we'll see if he won't. I doubt that he'll be, you know, or I know he won't be 100% at that time, but we'll have to wait and see how it's going and make a judgment on Thursday.
All right, Mark, if you want, I can write a note for the kids if they're late for school, since we're talking to you here early on a Monday morning.
Yeah, I don't. The note would have more pull if it was from the guru, Seth, than it
was.
Oh,
really?
Okay. No question. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's like, you know.
I thought I had a little clout with the teachers. All right.
Yeah. From the Dalai Lama or something.
Guru, I got a new role. No longer coach, no longer whacked coach, no longer you know nothing, you just hate Duke. I became a guru today.
Well, Mark, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
And when we come back here on Courtside, we're going to talk to Georgia Tech head coach Josh Pastner, potentially the ACC Coach of the Year.
Shot clock at 6. Farrell curls down the lane. A fadeaway baseline. Rim's no good. Patrick Jackson the rebound. 3 seconds to go. Up court. Hits Sasa Cody. 1 second. Lays it up. Lays it in. His time expires. He lays it in. He lays it in. Josh Okogie with the fast break. Live at the horn. Oh, could we have a Thriller Dome throwback for the Jackets?
Josh Okogie with the game-winning layup, 62-60, as Georgia Tech takes down Notre Dame. And that's Georgia Tech IMG with the call. And now joining us here on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line, Georgia Tech head coach Josh Pastner. Josh, had you heard that call prior to us playing it for you?
I was just about to say, it kind of gave me a little chills like that with that call like that. That was pretty intense. And, man almighty, that I might need to get a copy of that and then replay it to our guys, you know, to kind of get them pumped up before our next game.
How high did you jump?
You know what? I didn't jump. I raised both arms in the fist, like I felt like I was in the Rocky movie when he went all the way up the stairs and, you know, and gave both two fist pump with both arms up in the air. And because I saw what happened was you know, Farrell missed the shot. Todrick Jackson rebounded the ball. And Eric Reveno, my assistant, was – behind me saying, let him play, like not to call a timeout. I still had a timeout. And I felt, you know, I wasn't going to call a timeout. I heard him say that. It was just kind of how it happened. And we let him play, and Todrick Jackson had the self-awareness to rebound the ball, take a dribble or two, gather himself, throw it ahead to Josh Okogie, who has been really good for us, was not good at all at Cambridge Notre Dame. But the speed that he had when Todrick threw it to him, he was so fast to get that for the ball from the catch and the burst of speed with one dribble to lay it up. And I saw it go through, and I knew that it was going to count. It wasn't going to be after the clock or anything. And I went down to go, you know, after I kind of gave a double fist bump in the air, I went down to shake Coach Bray's hand. And I think he was in shock. Like I think he thought there was going to be another 5 minutes. It just, because it happened so fast. It was such a bang, bang play. But fortunately we were on that end of it. Listen, I've been on the other end of it. And I know that feeling. So you stay in the game long enough, you're gonna get a few go your way.
So Josh, this is almost like Leicester City in the English Premier League. You know, out of nowhere, this team comes and wins it. And I'm not saying you're gonna win the ACC or win the national championship, but you've won a number of games that nobody predicted prior to the season, where you've knocked off Carolina, Florida State, Notre Dame. You've won at NC State. You've won at VCU. You have no bad losses at this juncture. And if the tournament were held today, I would put your wins up against a lot of other teams and say, you know what, this team actually has better wins and maybe should go into the NCAA tournament. How did this happen?
Well, I wish I could tell you it was some great coaching job and everything else, but it wasn't. I can tell you what it is our team. We've gotten better. We've become a good team. You know, nothing has changed from who we are from the beginning of the year when I was there with Coach Greenberg and at the ACC media day that in talking about the rebuild job that this is going to take. There's nothing's changed from when I got the job and they told me that this is a major rebuild job, that there's a good chance you're not winning a game your first year in the ACC. You might not even win a total of 20 games total over your first 2 years. We are the most inexperienced team in the country. We are the same team that had to go to overtime to win our exhibition game to start the season. What I would tell you is we've gotten better, but we've become a good team through team unity, through guys really – just believing in each other, and it just maybe shows even for me, when everyone talks about team, you know, sometimes that can be used a lot and in sports and athletics, but this is a great example of how a team can win. And this really comes down to team unity. And so, we've become a good team. Nothing has changed as in terms of our margin for error is zero. Our severe limitations that we have on the offensive end, the amount of deficits that we have within our individuals that makes it tough for us. But the team has sometimes overcome some of those issues. Now, what I would tell you also is, for us, we have to be near perfect, near perfection if we want to have a chance to have success in the areas of energy, of effort, and of execution. And right now, we lead the ACC in field goal percentage defense in conference play. We're second in the league in assist in conference play. So those type of things of execution and energy and effort, which you see on the defensive end, is why we've become a good team to this point. And Andy, if the tournament was today, I would tell you that we should be in the NCAA tournament based on our wins and our resume. However, there's a lot of games left, and this league is a gauntlet. And we, like I said, our margin for error is zero. So if we don't perform at the level that we need to perform at and have the perfection in the areas that we can control, it can still be a long year for us because there's just, as I've said many times, our margin for error is zero.
Josh, what did you take away from your Memphis experience that's helping you take over a totally different type of program? Let's face it, the expectation at Memphis is almost unrealistic. You're following a Hall of Fame coach. You go to Georgia Tech, and it's a total rebuild. But what did you take away from that Memphis experience that's helping you move forward at Georgia Tech?
Coach Greenberg, that Memphis experience was great for me. I mean, I learned a whole heck of a lot and we did a lot of good. I mean, I've said it many times. I mean, Coach Calipari's last 4 years, I mean, they'd won over 90% of the games there. I mean, I was an assistant with him, and I understood what, you know, whoever was going to follow this guy, it's going to be impossible, literally. And I've tried to tell people, you know, hey, if you could have, when Coach Calipari left and nobody wanted the job, if you could say, hey, the coach was going to be a first-time head coach, be the fastest in Memphis history to 150 wins, win 70% of his games, and leave there after 7 years, 10th in the history of the NCAA for most wins in the first seven-year period. And I would try to remind people in Memphis that, hey, who wouldn't sign up for that at the time when Coach Calipari left, because nobody at the time wanted the job. And so I was thrown in that, and you're just going to, you know, just, you know, right into the fire. And so I learned a lot, and I probably – the two things that I took away from them, there's so many things I could tell you, good, bad, or indifferent, but the two main things, I think, one is all about self-awareness. I think in leadership is so critical about self-awareness. And so what was I most self-aware on the areas that I learned from that? And I think probably the key thing of anything is alignment. And you might say, what does that mean? What's alignment? The alignment that I recognize is that I've got to have everyone, whether it's assistant coaches, support staff, managers, and also the student athletes that we recruit, have to be aligned to me on what our vision is, on how I want our culture to be, on what we want to achieve, and how we want to get there, and what the DNA of our team to be about. And if that alignment, if a guy or two is not aligned to me, it's going to make it really, really hard. And you can get you know can have obstacles along the way on that. So I think of anything, coach, is the alignment factor is more than anything.
Yeah, and speaking with that, you hired a coaching staff that actually has a former head coach on it. Was that something that you wanted to do, building your staff and trying to get an understanding of having different guy type of people, a West Coast guy, obviously a guy that understands the region. How did you put together your staff? How are you trying to – what's your vision moving forward in relation to the staff you put together?
Well, Coach Greenberg, I really took my time before I hired the staff. And I haven't been in an academic institution where, you know, the admissions are different than where I've been. And so I hired three guys because I felt in the rebuilding process, first and foremost, I felt in a major rebuilding process, the three most important things is staff, recruiting, and scheduling, you know, making sure that you hire the right staff. And I believe I hit a home run on that, on the guys that I hired. I hired all guys who've been in academic institution. Eric Revenot was the head coach at Portland, but was the assistant at Stanford for a long time, played at Stanford, got his master's from Stanford, and then coached at Stanford and was very good with the big guys at Stanford, Lopez twins, Collins twins, Mark Mattson. And you know there's a lot of good bigs out there that have good academic backgrounds. So he's been in that environment. Tavares Hardy, who I got from Georgetown, but played at Northwestern, coached at Northwestern, and then coached at Georgetown. And Daryl LeBerry, who graduated and played at Georgia Tech, and was there with Paul Hewitt, and then was at recently with Ron Hunter at Georgia State. So all three guys are really good coaches, but they're really good understanding of the lay of the land of an academic situation. And so it's you know, I really focused in on that, on the importance of hiring of the staff. I took my time. I didn't rush. I was by myself, literally running an ACC program for weeks. But I did not want to make a rash or rush decision on the staff hiring, because I felt the three most important things in the rebuilding process was staff, recruiting, and scheduling.
Josh, you had a great contract situation. I mean, that was public knowledge. And you landed in a great situation at Georgia Tech, obviously did well financially. But was there any point where you were legitimately concerned about, you know, what was going to happen in your coaching career as things were, you know, the outside noise was getting a little louder at Memphis before this opportunity created itself for you at Georgia Tech?
Well, look, you get to a place and you're at 7 years, and I understood. I mean, I understood what I was walking into when I followed Coach Calipari. I mean, I knew the reason I got the job was because nobody wanted the job. Nobody wanted the job. I mean, at the time, you know how many people got raises? Because Memphis went after so many people, but nobody wanted to follow them. And most people probably thought it might only last a year. And so I got the job because literally I was last man standing. And at the time, probably half the city was thinking, what are we doing hiring this guy? Maybe even three-fourths of the city. Now, I thought we rallied the fan base, and we had a great seven-year run. I mean, you win 70% of your games, as the statistics that I mentioned earlier, and had all those great wins and many great things and great players for the program. I mean, six guys off my staff there have become head coaches that work there at Memphis. So, you know, we had a good run. But, you know, it's probably about 7 years, you start falling more in love with the place. And I love Memphis. I love the people. I love the city. I loved everything about Memphis. Sometimes, though, about 7 years, you fall more in love with it, and maybe people fall out of love with you. And I just think it's one of these things in this day and age. I mean, it's different. I think it's harder now than maybe it's ever been. And I think Coach Greenberg would agree with me that it's staying at a place, you know, about a seven-year window. I mean, if you're not Final Four championship every year almost, especially with the expectations that Memphis has, you know, people can get, you know, hey, you know, they might say, hey, let's see what else is out there, or they can be some grumblings. I understand that. That's part of the business. And so when this opportunity came, I jumped on it because I looked at it was a rebuild situation. They've had success. They're starting from ground zero. It's a startup company is the way they're looking to build this thing. And it was going to take time. And I had an opportunity to put my, you know, my own footprint on it, basically. And so this was exciting for me. And I think I probably wasn't the first choice here at Georgia Tech. I'm sure some other people probably, when they went through the interview process and told them the dire situation that it was literally going to take years to get it back, and it was literally a startup company, and you're going to go through some long stretches of losing, I'm sure probably some people said, I don't want to deal with that. But for me, because I was on, I've dealt with the other end of it, I said, hey, what a great thing, and it's different. And to say if we can have some success here, to say I've done it just individually as a personal deal, to do it both ends of the spectrum, I think it's, you know, just for me own personally, it's a neat thing. And to be determined if we can get it done here. We've done nice for this year, but there's still many games to go. We're not out of the woods, and we still got a long way to go to continue to build the program back up.
Well, Josh, we appreciate you coming on the show, and we wish you continued success. It's good for all of us because you're a good talker.
Well, I appreciate it. Anytime you can have me on, I appreciate it. I always appreciate you guys having me on. I really do.
Well, thank you, Josh.
All right, bud.
Thanks, guys.
All right, Seth, let's look ahead to the week here very quickly. Huge game on Wednesday in the Big 12. It seems like there always is one when we get to February. Baylor at Kansas. How do you see that one breaking down?
You know, it'll be interesting to see how Kansas handles coming back after playing the Kentucky game, obviously, in a string of games where you have West Virginia, Kentucky, and Baylor, three very different basketball teams. I think this game is going to come down to rebounding. Baylor's, you know, they have the size, the length, the athleticism in their front court, and can Kansas keep them off the glass? Can they keep them out of the paint? I think that's going to be a really important thing. And then, you know, for Kansas offensively, how do they attack that zone? Can they get the ball in the paint and pitch it back out? Can they get to the offensive glass? Can they get out and transition? Pace of the game will be interesting. Baylor wants to play close to the vest. Kansas need to get it up and down and get ahead of the defense.
A couple other quick ones here on Wednesday. I'm curious to get your opinion on. We talked about Northwestern at the top of the podcast. They're at Purdue on Wednesday night. Purdue coming off a loss at Nebraska. If Northwestern beats Purdue, that kind of takes Purdue out of the chase for the Big Ten title and puts Northwestern right there with Wisconsin and Maryland, you know, step for step. How do you see that one?
I'm a big Northwestern fan. I like the way they're playing. I think Purdue at home is a different animal. Purdue, I think Matt Painter's done a great job of putting this team together. What I mean by that, he's got guys who can really shoot the ball on the perimeter. He's got a legitimate low post, high post player. Got step out big and Biggie Swanigan, who shoots the ball. He's a tough matchup when he's at five. He's a tough matchup when he's at four. Then they bring in Isaac Hyson off the bench, and they go to some more high-low offense. You know, look, winning on the road is really hard. Nebraska's beaten some good teams at home. It's nothing like it's, you know, it's not earth-shattering in league play, but Purdue at home, their size, their physicality up front with the two bigs when they play together, and then their ability to make shots so that you can't shrink the court. I expect Purdue to find a way to win that game.
All right, so one more for you before we get to student section. Florida State is at Miami on Wednesday night. This is game three of a three-game road swing for the Seminoles coming after playing six straight ranked opponents. So really, cumulatively, it's a gauntlet of nine straight games for the Seminoles. They went 5-1 in that six. Now they're 0-2 in these last two road games. How much do the Seminoles need this road win at Miami?
Well, it's really hard scheduling. I mean, if, you know, obviously, look, you play in the ACC, you're going to play a number of elite basketball teams back-to-back, ranked basketball teams back-to-back-to-back. That's just the way it is. It's the way the league, you know, the teams in the league and what they've accomplished in non-conference and what they've been able to accomplish moving this season. Playing three games on the road following that gauntlet is suffocating. And there's a, you know, team chemistry. It's hard to find, it's harder to keep, and it's very fragile. So this will be a test for Florida State's team chemistry. Now, Leonard Hamilton is really good with his basketball team. He stays in the present. He coaches them every day. But the tempo of this game, again, I think shot selection will be important, because if you take bad shots against Miami and then they go down the other end and they grind you a little bit, put you in all those ball screens, it could be tough. They've got to push and get easy baskets, because Miami does do a good job of keeping you out of the lane in their half-court defense. So they got to run on opportunity, Florida State, but they got to take good shots. And when they take those shots in transition, they got to get to the glass. On the other end, in their half court, you've got to keep Newton out of the lane. You've got to do a good job on Brown, and you've got to do a good job of making sure they get one shot and one shot only. I expect, as good as well as Miami played this weekend, I would expect that Florida State, with a little bit different sense of urgency, with a little bit more discipline in their shot discipline, I would expect that Florida State finds a way to win this game in a last possession game.
You know, I'll say this. I don't know if I've seen a schedule for a team that's as grueling as Florida State in a conference, because, by the way, they finished the ACC with four of their final six on the road. however they get through this 18-game schedule, they're going to be obviously a better team for it, but they are going to be beaten up. All right, let's head to the student section after a weekend of a number of storms.
And here they come, folks. Here they come.
It's time for you to storm the podcast. Let's hear from the student section.
Yeah, Seth, what do you make of the various court stormings over the weekend? Legal, illegal? What's the
verdict? You know, I'm really disappointed in your alma mater. Look, it is great. They get a breakthrough win, and you know it was emotional, and you know they've struggled this season. But there are certain things. I mean, come on, Josh.
I agree. Syracuse does not storm the court against Florida State. I agree.
You just
never.
You just
under any
don't. You just
maybe you storm the field
that.
If you beat Florida State in football.
That's a different story. Yeah, the goalposts
very
would come
good
down.
Point.
Yeah.
The goal. You know what? Actually, that would be mandatory.
Absolutely.
See, that fits. That fits the rules of court. And being you're in the dome, are you storming the court, the field, or whatever? But very disappointing. I'm just telling you. I'm not an old man to stay off my lawn. I love court storming, but there's got to be some rules.
Yeah, that one was illegal. That one was illegal. Right. No question about it. But
from a Syracuse guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Embarrassing.
It was definitely embarrassing, but a good ACC win for the Orange for sure. And speaking of the ACC, we have this question from Temp User at Temp User 17. Awful Twitter handle. Nice question. Will the ACC champion finish with more than five losses, and which game down the stretch will determine the regular season title? Duke UNC, Louisville Notre Dame, or something else?
Okay, more than five losses. Carolina has two. Virginia has two. So that's telling me that one of those two schools is going to lose four more games? I don't know if I buy that. I'm going to say no.
Yeah, I'm going to say no as well. And, you know, I think it's going to be a game that's involving, my gut feeling, the champ is going to be involving Virginia. I just have this gut feeling that right now Virginia is in a good flow. They're doing a better job defending the post. They're doing a better job of closing out on the three-point shot. You know, I'm going to say it could come down to Virginia, North Carolina, February 27th, 7 p.m.
That sounds like a game day game. Is that a Saturday? That should be game day.
I don't know if it's a Saturday.
Let's check it out.
Walking calendar?
That's a Monday.
Oh, that's a Monday. Okay. Yeah. Big Monday. Great. That's the last big Monday. Great big Monday.
That's big. They also play North Carolina on a Saturday, 2:18.
Yes. Very interesting. Yeah. All right.
I think Virginia, North Carolina will determine the ACC champion.
All right. So we answered the question.
Next question from Eric Aldridge at ealdridge1389. He says, watching UK, KU, and Villanova, UVA over the weekend, should conference play start earlier so that we can get more out-of-conference challenges like this in January and February once football ends?
Ooh, I remember an argument about this.
Wait a second. Is that Jay Billis' alter ego? Look, let me ask you a question. We just had two great games, and the SEC Big 12 Challenge obviously is going to go on for a number of years. The Virginia, you can schedule some of these games. Like, to me, I think Gonzaga, they should schedule some
games.
And they
have in the past. They just aren't this year.
Yeah, because it's hard. You know why? All right. So now that I have some time.
Yes.
I can explain why this doesn't happen. See, because to schedule these type of games, and Jay Will had a great idea. You take the top three teams from conferences, and you crisscross them, and you play the games.
You can't get them
over a certain amount. You can't get them, because here's the thing. No one's playing a game that they're not going to get a return game on.
Correct.
Right? I mean, so that becomes a difficult thing. So it can't be three different teams every single year. It's going to have to be over a period of time. Number two is everyone has a bye week at a different time. Number three is every league plays a different amount of games. Everyone doesn't play 18 games. Someone plays 16 games. So you've got to get those league games in. How many coaches want to play a conference game in December when the students aren't there? None. How many coaches want to play a conference game in the first 3 weeks of your season when you really haven't developed your identity? None. So scheduling is so difficult. It's the hardest thing to do. You heard Josh Pastner earlier talk about, you know, how you build a program. Scheduling was a part of it. Do I think these games are great? Yes. Do I think that we can get certain games? I have one idea. If we took the concept of Champions Classic and we took four teams, four different teams, because let's face it, games that resonate. That was a great game, no doubt about it, Villanova, Virginia. What teams resonate nationally? Villanova, Virginia, is that a game that resonates nationally? That's a question, guys.
Well, I will say this. It, you know, to the junkie, yes, not to the mainstream fan. But to the NCAA selection committee, these are great games I just want to say two quick things. One, every team is judged individually. And when they look on the selection committee sort of cheat sheets, it never mentions what conference you're affiliated with. So these games are judged independently. That's why they're great. And one thing on the SEC Big 12 Challenge where I thought it was hurt was by the fact these things were scheduled so far in advance. To your point,
bad
Seth.
Matchups. Bad matchups.
But to your point, because it was scheduled so far in advance, no South Carolina. You know, South Carolina is one of the three best teams in the SEC this season. They're not part of it. Why? Because, to your point, Seth, everything has to be done so far in advance that they had to decide in 2014, and South Carolina wasn't as good then, and so they didn't pick them.
Yeah, and look, I'm all for great games. But scheduling, finding games that resonate. So my concept is you take four other traditional programs, whomever they may be. It might be Louisville, it might be Indiana, it might be Arizona, it might be UCLA, whomever it is. And you create a champions-type classic in advance, four teams, do it four different sites, same concept, east, south, midwest, west. You rotate it around those to the four different regions. And now you've created another national event that resonates nationally. Because I'm not saying, look, the Virginia-Villanova game is a great game. Cincinnati-Xavier was a great game. All right, but you can't just say, oh, we're going to do X, because most schedules
are backloaded. So if you want to play one of these games, and Kansas is an example, you want to play one of these games and say we're just going to do that, all of a sudden a team could end up going road, road, road. You want to take your team on three road games, excluding maybe Florida State, in the middle of your league season in February where you can get whacked three times? I don't think so as a coach. You're trying to build momentum at that time of the year moving forward for the NCAA tournament. But if you randomly play these type of games and they're on an opponent's court, there's a chance, all right, one, you're going to have a turnaround game Saturday to Monday because you've got to get all your games in, or Saturday to Tuesday, or Thursday to Saturday, which is hard. Number two is if you get that game sandwiched into between two road games, man, I'll tell you one thing. That becomes a very difficult time of the year for that team, and you do not want to get into a tailspin if you're in a major conference at the first week of February to last week of January.
All right, guys.
Makes sense.
One more. It does make sense, Seth. It does make sense. One more to close us out here from the Drew Abides, at Drew_Allen14. He says, was this past week more revealing for teams at the top or for teams fighting for a bubble spot?
Good question. I think the team's at the top. I think that, but here's the thing. Who is the top? I think every team has scars. There's no one that genuinely, the young teams are playing on potential. The old teams are playing on experience. We saw 8 of the top 10 teams, if I'm not mistaken, get beaten this weekend. We didn't see any crazy upsets. What we're seeing is the bottom of conferences are basically more competitive with the middle of the conferences. At home, they can play better. But if you look at the upsets of the weekend, what, you know, Georgia Tech, sure, that helped them, but they've got a lot of basketball play, home game, and they have a chance to, you know, they've got to build on that. But I think the teams at the top, what we're finding out, that there's a very small margin of error for everyone, especially when the elite teams play the elite teams.
My answer to that, guys, is essentially that, you know, it's late January. A lot of these games were on the road for these teams, and so I wouldn't read too much into it in terms of who benefited more. I still think we've got another month to figure all that out. All right, so Josh, if people want to ask us a question, what do?
They can use the hashtag student section on Twitter.
And they
can also, while they're on their phones, they can go to the ESPN app and subscribe to our show in the ESPN app in the Listen tab. Now, the difference between doing that and subscribing to it using different services is when you subscribe to it in the ESPN app, you get alerts. When we publish the podcast, you can be the first one to listen to it. So a little sense of exclusivity if you subscribe to us through the ESPN app.
Everyone loves that. Now, where else can we find the podcast?
iTunes, Stitcher, Slacker, anywhere where you find any other audio, but in the ESPN app, get a little extra.
All right. And as always, you can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth on Hoops, and you can follow me on Twitter at ESPN Andy Katz. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Courtside with Katz and Coach G. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app or download and listen on Apple Podcasts. Courtside with Katz and Coach G.